welcome to Neighborhood Church. To learn more about who we are as a community or to financially support Neighborhood, go to neighborhoodchurchmn.org. Enjoy the message.
All right. All right, well, we are going to start. We are continuing our series on the Psalms, and we only have two left. I saved this one. I was just telling Anthony downstairs. I'm like, during the middle of worship, I know what I'm speaking on, and I also knew that there was no neighborhood kids, and I didn't put those two together. Because today we're talking about Psalm 51. If you're familiar with Psalm 51, you're going to find out. And so I will make some pivots in my language, but I think the tone will be the same. And I had something there's hot water being brewed right now. I don't remember who. Hot water's coming, all right? So if you need more hot water in like 3 minutes, Sarah's going to go down and grab it. Thank you, Sarah, for grabbing it. So today, Psalm 51 came out of this place of my wife, Nikki, and I. We were in the kitchen, and she said, someone that she follows on Instagram who is a historian and a politician, and then also dabs in political commentary, who we both really like. And one thing she posted on her story was that the Bible has a high view of women. And Nikki goes, Chris, do you think the Bible has a high view of women? And Nikki was a pastor for 20 years. She's very familiar with the Bible, and she's incredibly wise if you have the pleasure of meeting her. And so when she asked me, I'm like, I feel like this is not a trick question, but I'm like, she knows the answer to this. So you know how when people, especially the one that you are married to or that you love a lot, they ask you questions, you're like, there's a plain answer, there's an obvious answer, then there's an answer behind the answer. And that's where I live, which is not always fun, right? And I said, well, knowing who this the idea of who this person is, I would say I could see how they think they have a high view of women, because it all depends on where you start, right? The Bible is a complicated, beautiful, wonderful, sacred, nuanced book that we talk about often. But if you were raised in a progressive church, like I hope that the kids that have come here believe, and I do believe that God sees humans as flourishing. Regardless, that God is, I believe God doesn't have a gender. I believe God is the fullness of the human experience, which is infinitely vast, right? And so if that's all you know, of course you can walk around saying, the Bible has a high view of women, and I love that. But if you take the Bible in its entirety, I would say it doesn't. And that's because it was written by marginalized people, for marginalized people, who still marginalize people. It was written where patriarchy informed everything. Very different than today, obviously, right? And that was a joke, right? Some of you are like, do we have to burn this place down? No, you don't. So, but that song and that narrative was still the same back then, right? That men's preferences was the preference. And whatever they wanted is what happened. Everything else that they didn't want, somehow, like, people who win get to write the history books, right? That's the Bible. Bible is written with patriarchy in mind, absolutely. And so, and then also, the Bible is this complex book, meaning there's, I should know this, I went to seminary, 62? Somewhere between 60 and 66 books, right? All right. We're written all at different places, all different times, all by different people. And then here's the kicker, edited by communities of people, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And so things that got left in, you have to understand and think, who benefits by this being true? Right? And funny, the story of men benefits men over and over and over again. And if you can understand that's how the Bible was put together, and understand that's maybe intentionally how it was put together. But the Bible's not written for what did we used to, there's a song when I was growing up called Burlap to Cashmere, the band. And does anyone know that band? Nicole, this is my, all right? And they sing a song called the Bible being an acronym for basic instructions before leaving Earth. Another way of thinking is like if you open up into your car and there's a car manual, it's going to tell you if this light comes on, here's what you do. Here's how the maintenance of vehicle, all that stuff. And some people, that's how they think the Bible. It's giving us basic instructions before we're supposed to go off to heaven. And if you read the Bible, you'd quickly understand that is not at all how it goes, because they leave the stories which we're going to read in the Bible. They leave contradictory statements. They leave horrible, horrible injustices that they did. The Hebrew people did, and they left the stories in there. Why? Because they were unafraid of it? I highly doubt that. I think they left it in there. And if you want to talk about how the Bible was put together and how it was written and why, I would love that. We can nerd out. If there's any people like, I want to know more about the Bible, we can go through of exile and Second Temple and all that stuff of why. But basically, they put it, all the stories together so they could tell the future generations, do not repeat our mistakes. You have to learn. Part of American history, well, until recently, right, with the Smithsonian Museum, we put problematic stories of our country in it so people can look at it and say, we did what? We allowed that to happen? We stood by and let that horrible injustice go on? And we could say, well, it didn't affect us. So we were silent. And something I learned, right, from activism is if it can happen there, it can happen here. And if we don't do anything about it, well, then it could happen, not maybe to us, but to our kids or our kids' kids, right? That's that is how the Bible is written. Oh, which changes, which may be sad for some people. If you're watching online, you're like, oh, right? It's a beautiful, complicated book on purpose. And I saved Psalm 51 for the end of summer before we get into the dark night of the fall and the winter. I don't bring up these sermons then because we're already sad enough, right? So Jeff Gilboy, who was one of my mentors, who was a pastor, he's the one who told me, he goes, Chris, you pick one Sunday in the summer, and you let that be the banger of in your mind that you've been thinking about, and this is it. And so I hope that this brings encouragement, and I'm going to use more expansive language so that it can it's a hard message, right? So I'm going to just start by reading it. And Psalm 51 is beautiful. I'm only going to read half of it because it's very long. It'll give you an idea of what is happening. Psalm 51 is written by David, if you know David and Goliath, if you know King David. This is David, and it is a confession. Psalm 51. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love. According to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash away all my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, and you only, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. So you were right in your verdict and justified when you judge. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. Yet you desired faithfulness even in the womb. You taught me wisdom in that secret place. Cleanse me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness, and let the bones you have crushed rejoice. Hide your face from my sins, and blot out my iniquity. Create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me from your presence, or take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore me to the joy of your salvation, and grant me a willing spirit to sustain me. It's beautiful. It's honest. It's raw. Here is King David, who's currently king when he wrote this. He got caught. He got exposed. He got Me Too'd. Right? He got called out. This was not a willing confession. This is a man, a king, a powerful person who got busted and now is putting into song, putting into communal corporate worship, what we've used, putting into the sacred book a public confession for the wrongs that he did. And he's begging out to God. And we're going to talk about that because confession is not something like you hire a clown for a birthday party, right? You don't hire a pastor to come in, all right, kids, who wants to confess, right? It's not a party element. It's not a fun element. But if you've ever been to a point where you need to confess something either that you have done or done against you, or something that is beautiful and wonderful, confession is intoxicating on all ends of that spectrum, because you're putting language, you're putting words to your experience. And something in that experience moved you deeply. And when you can express it for the first, you've been there before? When you finally say those words, I love you, or you say the words, I need help, or you say the words, I need to go to therapy, whatever it is, it feels so alive. And this is what David is doing. And we're going to talk about the power of confession. But what is David confessing to? When I was in undergrad in Bible college, I was thinking of all the messages I heard in my life. Everything I heard about David is that he's a hero of faith. He's a patriarch of our tradition. He is one of the celebrated figures, and never once, not once, did I hear any pastor ever say that he committed sexual assault. Not once. If you know the story about David and Bathsheba, David is on a roof, and he's looking out, and he sees Bathsheba, and she is bathing. Right? We'll use that word, right? And he sees her, and he's overwhelmed with desire, and he takes what he believes belongs to him, right? And now, there's a lot of words to describe what happened that we're not going to use that you can imagine, right? And I've heard people talk about it, and they use it in the way of, in Luke, where they put down the genealogy of Christ and how Jesus, through the bloodline, came to be the Messiah. And David is one of those people. And everything I've heard about David, he's a king, he is great, he's wise, he's pure of heart. And then when they get to that story, they're like, oh, but he's redeemed. David is redeemed. What a beautiful story. If David can be redeemed for his transgressions, right? That's the word they'd use, transgressions, for his mistake, for his oops, then what a story for us. And we can find redemption, and we can find wholeness. And it's absolutely true. But the problem is they silenced Bathsheba's name. Because what is Psalm 51 about? Did you hear anything about a victim? Did you hear anything about feeling sorry for other people? No. And when we decide to read the Bible in that way, all the power and all everything we center is on David and David being a great person. And is he a great person? I'm indifferent on it. I don't care how great he was. What I care is, in patriarchy, in history, can you put them in the same place, men have access to power and believability. And because of that, sacredness that is not offered to the victims. It's not offered to the people who are silenced. Not even silenced, erased. It's not, it's just, she's gone. But we read Psalm 51 in churches, and as we can, I'm not going to say we should, as we can, because it is beautiful. And there's elements that we can pull that we're going to talk about for a second about confession that are really, really important. But we have to hold those in tension with the reality that what David did is evil. What David did is horrible, because he sends her husband to the front of the lines, he's murdered, and David does everything he can to cover it up. And then we just say, well, he asked for forgiveness and he confessed. That's great. If you've ever been around any kind of public confession, usually it's a politician, a pastor, right? A celebrity. And they get up and they have heartfelt expressions. And there's been a couple that I've read about and have watched where they confess before they get caught. Most of the time, why are you confessing? Because I need to, because I got busted. Right? Which for me, as a father working with my kids, I want to teach them about confession. I want to teach them about forgiveness. I want to teach them about owning your mistakes. But when it only goes as far as saying, my wife is next to me, and why is their partner next to me as they're confessing these horrible, horrible things? Because it makes him look good. And why did they confess to you? Because they got caught, and we are told, I was told this multiple times, so I'm not going to get into all that, right? Get ahead of the story, Sodder. Get ahead of the story. And getting ahead of the story just means me before you, right? Getting ahead means we're not going to be victim-centric. We're going to be on spinning things to benefit one party over the other. And to me, that is not the kingdom of God. That is not what I read in the Bible. That is not a Jesus-looking way. And there's something we can learn on confession, and there's something we can learn about how the Bible was written. Because the way you read the Bible matters. There's a lot of people I talk to that have given up, chosen not to, or just become indifferent of the Bible because of its complications that it brought in their own life. And I'm 100% in favor of that. If it is not life-giving to you, put it down. Right? If it is not serving you, like I remember being told by this person saying that they knew who was praying and reading the Bible every day, what we called devotions at the time. They're like, I know who's doing it because I can sense it in my spirit. And I took that as this person has prophetic wisdom and God is telling them what I am doing and not doing. And guess who did their devotions every day because of that? This guy. And what I learned later on is they could gauge who's doing the devotions based on how you centered his pleasure and his power. And that would, he'd be like, well, they probably won't ring the Bible because they didn't agree with me. Right? I think devotions is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thing. I love reading the Bible, but the way you read the Bible matters. And everything you read, you were wearing glasses, you're wearing a lens. And we'd like to think, no, I'm special. I'm different. I'm reading this Facebook post with neutrality. I'm reading the tweets of Gavin Newsom and Trump side by side, but I'm reading them with neutrality. I'm not letting my bias, my political persuasions inform me how to interpret this. It says a majority of people I talk to, and I always say, you're lying to yourself because you can't turn off your bias. You can't turn off your homophobia. You can't turn off your racism. You can't turn off your trauma. You can't turn off your education. So when you read the Bible, you're already entering into it wearing a specific kind of glasses. What I want to help us do as a pastor, I want us to be honest with the Bible because I love the Bible. But I understand I bring something into the Bible as well. And so we're going to talk about confession, and then we're going to talk about what are better ways to read and think about the Bible and ultimate reality or what we call God. So first, confession. Was anyone here raised Catholic? Raise your hand. Do you remember your first confession? Do you remember? You don't have to say it. Do you remember what you confessed? Yes. Okay. I was seven. I don't even know how. I was seven. I feel like 6 to 8. And I got to. And we went, it wasn't in the church. I think it was in the parish, which is already weird enough, right? And then I'm going in, and there's this weird room, and I'm supposed to kneel, and then there's like a piece of like insulation board, right? So it's only about like this wide, but then the priest sits on the other side of it, and I'm like, where am I supposed to go? And he's like, well, you're going this side. Like, obviously, Chris, you go over here. I'm like, why? There's a thing between us, and I know you're behind there. This is a bad game of hide and seek. And then he just says, well, what do you want to confess? He was very nice, and he probably used a much more like kid-friendly language. But I remember he saying, what do you want to confess? And I felt pressure, and I looked to my left, and there was balloons. And I'm like, I popped my brother's balloons. That's it, right? And then he's like, and he said something like, your sins are forgiven. I lied at first confession, right? That is, and I'm a pastor. That is my history. That's my trajectory, right? And so when I think about confession, and when people talk about confession, I go back to that boy because something inside me says it's not okay to say nothing. So confession at an early age, right, was informed of making someone else feel okay, not me. I'm doing it for them. And how much of childhood, how much of our teens, how much of our lives, and I'm saying this as a middle-aged white man, do I feel this pressure to perform for other people? Because if I don't perform, will I be loved? Will I be accepted? Will I be included? Will I be believed? And I want to be believed and loved and accepted. And so I will dance. I'll play this game. And that's not always how confession always really works. Like David says early on, he says, I should just read it for you. He says, blot out my my transgressions, wash away all my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin, for I know my transgressions. He's saying, I know I've done evil. I know I've done wrong. And God, you can erase all of it. It says you can make me, and this is a different interpretation, right? You can make me as white as snow, right? Sure. Snow, not super popular in that area of the world, right? But the idea of that we can be made something different. And confession, if you've ever been in that place of where you have to tell someone, you are afraid of missing out on love, right? And he says that, don't cast me away. Don't throw me aside. There is this absolute fear of being rejected by God, by love, by, and I'd imagine David has access to a level of power and influence because of his faith, because of the culture. All of it is touching. So he feels, if I do nothing, I'm cast aside. And if you've ever been there, that pressure, if I don't own this, what will I lose? That's not inherently evil. That's incredibly human. And there's something sacred about being able to have the wherewithal of sizing up of what is it I really want. I've been entering this, I've been doing this, I've been entertaining this, and it's no longer serving me. So you have to come clean. But then he says things like, I've known I've always been a sinner. Since birth, he says. Since I was a baby, I know that I've been sinning. This is a way of recognizing, as a man, have I always been like this? And whatever led me to this point of where I could do this horrible evil, I no longer want to participate in that. So he uses the word, create in me a new heart. And this is where we have songs written about this. There's posters about this. Right, Susie? There's a song, like, I can hear it in my head. Of creating me a new heart. Oh, God. That's all I remember is the oh part. And we sing it because it's beautiful. And he means it. He wants something new. And the Hebrew word in there for create a new heart is the same word in the Genesis story of how God creates something out of nothing. There is a new creation. There's a new existence. There's a new way of operating, a new way of believing. There's a new way of orientating a being human. And David is crying out saying, I want that again. Because whatever this is, whatever his heart is, it is not what I want. And the word they use of the creation and of the new, creating me a new heart, is a Hebrew word that is feminine. And it's out of the idea of being a womb. That newness is created in a womb. And as that human, as that life is expanding and growing and evolving, there are so many elements within a woman's body that is taking care of that new creation, that's adding it. It takes time. It takes energy. It takes green apples and fried chicken, according to my wife, right? That's right. It takes care. It takes emotional health. It takes seeing a doctor. There is this whole process in order for the life to happen and continue to grow on. And if we thought about confession that way, it changes it. Because a lot of times we think confession, especially the horrible confessions you've heard, as a transaction. I said it, now we're done. Let's move on. Who's ever heard that kind of apology before? It's not an apology. It's, I don't want to have to deal with the consequences anymore. Haven't we done this enough? How many more times do you want me to apologize for this? It's like, I don't know. Until I'm done? Until I can turn my cold heart off, apparently, right? When we treat apologies and confessions as transactions, it again erases and silences the victim. And I was just telling to a new friend, right? I'm a victim of spiritual abuse. There's things that were done to me and said to me and exploited in me and through me that I'm embarrassed by. I have done my work. I have walked through it with therapy, my doctor, a lot of stuff with God, and it still hurts. I can say it right now without crying. 2 years ago, there's no way. And I have my story, and you have your story, right? I have never gotten an apology from the people who, and I never will. And will I even accept it? That is a different question. I don't even know. I honestly can't even answer right now. And I'm indifferent on that. I never want to see those people ever again. Never. Even if they called me, I don't even know if I'd answer it. I don't have to worry about that, right? That is their story. probably make them feel better. I'm not interested in that. I have no ill will towards them. But when we treat confessions as transactions, it erases the impact. You ever heard, like, we taught our kids intent versus impact? And what a lot of people who get caught, then we say, well, you know, I didn't mean to use racist language. I have a lot of black friends, right? Come on, Chris, that's just locker room talk. Yeah, that's what she said jokes. Come on, that was in the office forever. It's okay. You're overreacting, right? If I heard that as a man, I imagine you have your own story. And when they put that on us as if we're the problem, that we're too sensitive, we're too woke, we have too many feelings, they're saying, my intent wasn't to hurt you. And I'm saying, that's fine. But the impact is, look at all the bodies that are behind this bus. I'm indifferent on your intent. We're all happy for you. Can you speak to the impact? And a majority of people I know have no, I shouldn't say no, they have little capacity to do that for a sustained amount of time, which in any kind of healing I've been a part of, it takes time, space, language, kindness, over and over again. And those places that are putting emphasis on the impact, on emphasis on the victims, there can be true healing and accountability. It's all that to say, what David is doing here, if we could separate it, which we are, and make it just for ourselves, which we can use the Bible for, there's a beautiful picture of feeling your feelings and crying out to God for a new creation, a new heart. Because confession then is not a transaction. Forgot to say this. It's a reorientation. If it's in the womb, it's going to take time, and you have to grow and culture and cultivate that new way of being, which is really, really beautiful and really hard. So, the last part, and this will be short. What are we supposed to do when we read stories like this and we know the real story? Because my friends and I, we'll have conversations on what's more important, the art or the artist? And if we look at, like, Van Gogh, or we go to jazz musicians, and we're like, their art is beautiful, and you learn about the artist and the toxicity they brought to people's lives and the damage they brought to people's lives, and it's almost like, what was the idea? Ignorance is bliss. Because once you learn the story of, let's say, like, from my generation, Michael Jackson, and you're like, whoa, but, like, Man in the Mirror, oh, yeah, it slaps. And then you're like, he did what? And you're like, oh, I can't listen to that music without thinking of that. Right? And it all depends on where you are in history, because I have people say, I remember, this is a little defiant, Chris Sauter in Bible college. They're like, well, we can't listen to, what did they used to call it? Secular music, all right? That's a trigger word, isn't it? Right? Secular music. And they're like, it can only be Christian music. I'm like, all right, well, then what about, like, Beethoven? Do we know anything about Beethoven? Oh, his music is so pure. It's so good. I'm like, did he ever, I can't use those words. Did he ever do things that were problematic? And they're like, well, we're not really interested in that. I'm like, oh, but you're interested, right? In what Snoop Dogg's doing? You're really interested in whatever? That's a bad comparison. Bah! Right? What I'm saying is, you can give grace as long as it benefits you. And you can give grace as long as you want, as long as you still keep winning. A phrase that I've used hundreds of times, I would love if you could remember, a way of processing political or theological or cultural or family systems, if we believe this to be true, who benefits the most? If we believe that this artist is good, but this artist is bad, and their art we can listen to, who benefits the most? If we believe that to be true. And 9 times out of 10, it's me. It's you. So how can we have better ways of reading the Bible? We can learn from our womanist and feminine and queer theologians, who the whole way of doing is, whose voice has been silenced, whose names have been eradicated. And what they do is, we have to tell their story. Where I first learned this was, what about the women who took care of Moses? What about the women that found Moses in the river? Was it really the princess that found it? More than likely not. It was probably slaves. And those women, those people took care of that baby of Moses and raised him alongside other people. But you never hear their stories. that's the first time, like, oh, do you know who bankrolled, honestly, do you know who bankrolled Jesus' ministry? Jesus didn't just, like, live on good vibes only, right? He wouldn't just create bread and wine for dinner. Do you know, like, it costs money. Do you know who bankrolled it? Does anyone know? It was a woman. It was women. It was the guy who was the accountant for the king, for Herod. She believed and heard about the message of what Christ is doing, and she used Herod's money that her husband got paid with to bankroll Jesus and Jesus' ministry. Isn't that crazy? Right? You never hear that story. It's in the Bible. You don't hear it. Why? Because it doesn't sound as good. Right? So the way we can read the Bible is when you see something problematic, when you see something and you read the story of David and Bathsheba and you're like, why are we moving so quickly through this? Who benefits the most? And if you can understand it, then the Bible becomes that much more alive. And alive doesn't mean easy. Alive doesn't mean, oh, rose-colored glasses, everything's fancy and happy. Alive means it's human. And that's the best news possible. Because sadly, assault happens to 1 in 3 women. Every 3 seconds, there's a sexual assault that happens. And I still remember I was 31, 32 when I first learned this. That took me 32 years old to learn that. And I was in the car, heard on NPR, looked at Nikki, I said, 1 in 3? And she looked at me like, who did I marry? All right, honestly. And I said, well, have you? And she goes, well, absolutely. I'm like, an assault, and we don't have to break it down, assault can be on this whole entire spectrum. Assault is always assault. And what do people do? It's just boys being boys. No, it's not. We can teach our boys to be better. We don't teach our girls how to hide it more, how to be silent more. We need to teach the boys how to be better. But all the attention goes to the girls, to the women. We can read better versions of the Bible by calling evil what's evil. Even in the Bible, God's going to be okay. She's doing just fine on her own, right? We don't need to defend God. What we can do is call sin, sin. And even that is a trigger word. Because how many times have men used, let's call sin, sin. And what is it on? It's on women wearing too short of shorts. I'm old enough to remember the spaghetti straps was the greatest injustice to humankind, right? Honestly. Right? How many times they hear about that? Don't make your brother stumble. All the blame and shame goes on the woman instead of telling the boy, the teenager, the man, go for a run, grow up, see a therapist, whatever it might be. We can do better. So this is where I end. Maybe you're here, and the idea of confession is something that you've been hoping for. I know me, there's been multiple times in my life where I feel like I was hiding things and I craved that someone would call me on it because I didn't have the strength to say it out loud. I'm like, oh, please, please, I'm going to walk into this room and there's going to be a group of people saying, hey, Chris, there's a better way of being human, right? I'm embarrassed that I felt that, but I'm also thankful because I got through it. Confession, whatever it might be, if you're feeling it, there's something holy inside of you. There's something human inside of you. And those are not at odds of one another, friends. Those are not at odds. To be human is to be holy. And to be holy is to be fully human. If you'd like to confess, we don't need to do it publicly. No, we're not doing that, all right? I got a couple things to say. Is when we're done, if you'd like to talk, and I say it every week, if you want to talk, pray. I don't use the word confession because it usually gets people's hearts racing a little too much, right? If you'd like to confess, and confession can look so many different ways. It could be, forgive me, God, for I have sinned. It could be, I have something to tell you. I'm going to look you in the eyes. I'm going to ask if you want me to pray with you, and you can say no. And that is okay because I only have so much power to absolve sins, all right, up to it. I'm joking, all right? But I have people saying, well, I want to get forgiveness. I'm like, then do it. That's between you and God. That's between you and whoever you hurt. If you'd like to confess, you can come. We can talk. If you want to set up a time, to talk, or we call private confession. That's just a cooler word than saying get coffee. My number's out in the back. My card's on the back, and I'd love to do that. And I'm also, if you'd like to talk about the Bible and new ways of reading it or new ways of thinking about it, or you want to talk more, we could talk much more in detail about the story of David and Bathsheba, and you have some questions, I'd love nothing more to do that. So I'm going to pray. I'd love to have you join me as we pray. So God, thank you for the complicated, beautiful, inspiring thing we call the Bible. And that we can be complicated, messy, and it's not a threat. At first, I pray for my friends who have been victims and the things they carry with them that maybe they have shared, have walked through, and all the things that we have buried. Lord, hear our prayers. Lord, hear our prayers that we vocalize, the prayers through tears, through the prayers through the nightmares, and also the prayers behind the empty stare, begging that no one asks us. God, hear our prayer. I pray for the generations behind us that we can hand a better story of what it means to be a human, what it means to be male or non-binary, that we can tell better stories about confession and intent versus impact. We can tell better stories of what it means to belong and be believed. And we tell better stories of what it means to be holy. So will you create in us a new heart, God? And not cast us away, that we wrapped up in your love. And we can be in that womb of new creation, of new love, of new energy, so that we can move forward to be new people and continue to move and operate in that newness. We love you. Amen. So, if you'd like to confess, thank you for clapping, Yuli. I appreciate that, right? If you'd like to pray or confess or talk, I'm going to be up here. You can grab my card. Secondly, I have a poem. It's a rereading of Psalm 51 through the eyes of Bathsheba. If you'd like to read it, I have it up here. I can email it to you. I can text it to you. I chose not to read it publicly because of time and audience. But if you'd like to read it, you can come up here and I can show it to you. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.